Well, good evening, everybody. I'm not quite sure how to follow after this fabulous entertainment, after being told that this is actually quite a historic evening. And I'm sure you've had a pretty heavy day with hard science and economics of climate change. I promise, I've tossed my PowerPoint presentation. I don't think you should have to endure that over dinner. I'm so grateful that that you know already that I'm not a climate change expert. I'm not even an energy economist. I'm actually a trade and labor economist. I work in Sydney because the World Bank's office in Sydney, which is actually fairly new. I've been here for 4 years. The office has been here for seven. And we look after the Pacific and PNG and Timor-Leste, which makes up a total of 11 small countries. And there's going to be a quiz afterwards to see if you know some of these countries. That being said, I will elaborate more in my talk, but I will say this at the outset. I've found, just in the course of the last 3 to 4 years working on the Pacific, that it's becoming very hard to work on development issues in the Pacific and not confront the issues of climate change. It's not something that you need to stretch your imagination for. It's not a hypothetical scenario at all in the Pacific. It's something you confront the first few meetings you have with people who live there. They're struggling with it. They've faced the consequences already, and the choices are pretty grim. I'll come to my patch and talk about Australia's neighbourhood a little bit later. But what I thought I might share with you are some of the World Bank's sort of global view on this, how the institution is positioning itself on climate change, and then talk a little bit about some of the region's efforts, Asia Pacific, and then talk about the part that I know and see every day, which is the Pacific. But how about I start? I looked for good climate change economist jokes, and I stumbled upon one. How many economists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is two. One, of course, to change the light bulb, the other to assume the ladder. I remind you again that the economics of development in the Pacific and climate change issues are really closely tied together. Well, I might just start with what our new president, Bob Zelic, who took over in July this year, has been saying about climate change. As soon as he took the office, he has actually articulated some of the main themes that the bank will be focusing on in the next 3 to 4 years, and climate change is very firmly on that list of five or six things. But as an institution, it's very clear, as an institution that works in 140 countries, low to middle income countries, we now only know quite well that it's the poor and the vulnerable that are disproportionately disadvantaged by climate change. In fact, I'm sure you've discussed some of these things in the day today, with weather patterns, which means more severe droughts, floods, inundation of water, add to that some spread of disease and reduced water quantities, lowered agricultural productivity, and what we see is really a scenario for very extreme and very major economic and social disruption in almost all parts of the world. And what Bob Zelic has said about climate change is that it challenges us as an institution and indeed as a global community of development professionals on how to balance growth with equity. And this is, of course, the main question right now facing policymakers, and how to balance today's needs with concerns for tomorrow. how to balance local needs with global priorities. And this is a huge challenge. We've only just begun to understand what it entails. Bob Zelick's actually gone beyond stating this as a priority and actually outlined 6 or 7 concrete ways in which the bank will be engaged. And I'll just go through these 6 or 7 things really quickly, 7 things actually really quickly. The first is supporting countries to incorporate adaptation and mitigation into their development plans, which is what we call mainstreaming of climate change issues, so that they're not just an add-on, but they're very much mainstreamed. I'll give you an example of that actually when I talk about the Pacific, so I'll just move on to number 2, which is innovative and very different financing mechanisms. The traditional bank mechanisms, which are the long-term loans and some grants, haven't found to be adequate at all for the sorts of challenges that climate change is going to bring. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Global Environment Facility, the various carbon funds that the bank manages, even the carbon finance unit that the bank houses, along with various partnerships with the private sector. I know a month from now in Bali, I think we're going to be launching what's known as the Carbon Forest Partnership. So there's a few of these, some that have been operational for a few years already and new ones to come. This is likely to be a very integral part of our engagement, the innovative financing part, because our estimates show that the global needs for sustainable energy are actually in the range of something like 20 trillion. So you definitely need innovative financing in this area. To give you an example of what I mean by innovative, there's a scheme being pilot tested in Mongolia to ensure livestock, for instance, where the bank is piloting this with the government to set up a contingency fund. We've just, maybe about 6 or 8 months ago, started a catastrophe fund, a regional risk pooling fund in the Caribbean, and I think it's time to begin to discuss some of those things in the Pacific as well, but it is operational in the Caribbean already. The third is building a knowledge base that strengthens market-based approaches to climate change, and by that again I mean mechanisms like the Carbon Fund, which is worth over more than $2 billion now, and the sorts of knowledge assets that are created are already obvious through the website, for instance, of this Carbon Finance Unit, which is supposed to be promoting an open and transparent way to disseminate information. We think it's pretty good, but if you guys have any comments or criticisms, I'd be very happy to take those messages back to this unit. Some years ago, we were very keenly involved in actually setting up the ground rules for the funds, improving access, lowering entry costs for newcomers, certainly for developing countries. An example of that is Indonesia's participation in a new fund that's going to award credits for activities that avoid deforestation in Indonesia. The fourth one is the encouraging of technology development and adoption. An example of that is our work in Philippines in trying to help them find cleaner technologies that reduce emissions. This actually leads in very quickly to the fifth point, which is working closely with our private investment arm, which is known as the IFC, to actually increase the attractiveness to the private sector of investing in cleaner technologies, including designing incentives for appropriate technology transfer. Integral to all of this, particularly if many of you will understand if you've worked with governments, is the need to do institution building to integrate climate change, again, into all economic thinking. There is no Ministry of Climate Change. Some of us that have worked with government might say, thank goodness there isn't. but it is. It does cause some delays because the whole issue of climate change requires a cross-cutting approach. It requires coordination across various stakeholders, not just within, certainly within government, but also across government, private sector, NGOs. And we in the bank and the IFC are working closely to try and do institution building with technical assistance and capacity building grants for all of these activities. And then finally, the big one, where we ourselves have a lot of learning to do, in actually working with countries to balance their growth objectives with environmental sustainability. As soon as you say this, you immediately think of countries like China and India. I can't speak to India, but China, which happens to be in the region that I work for, we have several initiatives. We are currently working with the National Development and Reform Commission to enhance energy efficiency, working with the Chinese government again to look at various scenarios, modeling various scenarios for a low-carbon growth study. There is another, a North China plain, which is the part of China, which is the breadbasket of China, a project to improve water storage and use, and then also working with various cities in China to improve mass transit systems. So that's just a very quick sort of overview of the bank's global position and a little sprinkling of what we're doing in the region, in the countries in the Asia-Pacific region. There's clearly more of this to come, and as I said, we also quite humbly acknowledge that while we've, on some activities, we've been involved for a very long time, we clearly are on the early part of our learning curve as well on how we actually help developing countries balance growth with sustainable development. Let me now talk about the part of the world that I have been working on for the last 4 years, which to the Australians and perhaps the New Zealanders here, if there are any, will quickly be recognized as your own neighborhood. And that's the Pacific. The Pacific is a very disparate region, lots of small islands, very remote. And when I say small, I really mean in terms of population as tiny as sovereign nation states that have a total population of 3,000 to the largest, which is Fiji, which is still only under a million. So micro states these are. And two really important things jump out about the Pacific, to me at least. The first is that it is an extremely vulnerable region to natural disasters and climate change. There's various indices floating out there on vulnerability. Almost any of them that you look at will put the Pacific countries that we work on somewhere in the high to moderate vulnerability. There's only a couple that are moderate. Most of the others are at extremely high risk. The other important thing to know about the Pacific is that they are extremely reliant on natural resources for their livelihood. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to put one and two together and immediately sit up and think there's probably serious trouble brewing around the corner. And let me spell out why I think there are some very serious issues to be faced in the Pacific, where actually already being faced in the Pacific. Why is vulnerability in itself such a big issue in the Pacific? Of course, it's any country that's vulnerable is concerned. I think the Pacific even more so because of their tiny size and scale. So when a cyclone destroys a crop, it's destroying the only export of that country. It's gone. Exports go from being whatever 5-6% of GDP to nothing all of a sudden. When a particular road or a bridge is damaged in one of these countries, that's the road that connects farms to the markets. It's the one road to the ports and the airport, and that's it. Nothing can get in and nothing can get out. And again, everything comes to a standstill. So it's a very stark reality where one cyclone, one natural hazard, and the country goes into a complete crisis. With small size, obviously, comes lack of capacity, lack of awareness, lack of instruments to actually cope with these extreme circumstances. And then on top of that, there are some moral hazard issues where donor funds are easily available as soon as a catastrophe strikes, but perhaps not so easily available, or not available on the same terms for adaptation and mitigation. And I hope this doesn't sound like I'm appealing to donors to not help when a catastrophe strikes, but there is an incentives problem here which needs to be sorted out and important, so that the wait and mitigate kind of scenario isn't what's practiced in the Pacific. That was the vulnerability. I also told you about how reliant they are on natural resources, and let me tell you why that is a problem. Well, if you ask any economist, even outside of climate change, they'll tell you that reliance on natural resources is a problem because it comes with a natural resource curse. But in the context of climate change, it's really important because what natural resources does the Pacific have? It has some forests, it has a lot of fish, and then the natural environment, which is conducive to tourism. So these are the three real sources of income. Forests, rapidly being depleted. Solomon Islands, the estimate is that in 6 years they will have absolutely no forests left. Right now it's about 70% of their exports. So they're just rapidly deforesting. Fish, a small country like Kiribati, which relies very heavily on fish catch, has suddenly found that they don't have any. And all of a sudden the country goes into a huge fiscal crisis because revenue has fallen. And tourism again, there's issues with the quality of the beaches, bleaching of coral reefs, all these sorts of things that are taking a toll on tourism, obviously imposing a very, very large and a disproportionately large burden on the poor in the Pacific. As these resources dwindle and become even more scarce, what immediately begins to happen is that what we call rent-seeking activities immediately increase, and then there's a huge strain on the governance structures, and you begin to see all forms of side payments and corruption and, you know, what we broadly term as poor governance in the natural resource sectors. This is quite a feature of the resource sectors in the Pacific. And something else that, sadly, I've observed in the last 4 years is that it's become a very serious source of conflict, both internal within the countries, amongst the tribes or amongst various, within the islands. Most of these countries are actually atoll structures. So one group that lives on an island versus another that has varying access to resources. This has been rapidly becoming a huge source of tension. And also international issues are coming up. There's certainly a very strained dialogue on international migration. It sounds a bit alarmist to say yet, maybe a little bit alarmist, but not overly so, to say that perhaps this region will be one of the first where the issue of environmental refugees might actually emerge very much within our lifetimes, very much within our working lifetimes. So it's something that's started to be discussed already, and it's a very difficult conversation. But I want to change the tone a little bit, just so I'm not dubbed as Miss Doom and Gloom. I want to end on actually two success stories in the Pacific, where countries have been able to do something about it, at least in their own little way. And actually maybe better than their own little way, actually large countries are taking notice and almost studying a couple of these examples in the Pacific and seeing what parts of these actions are actually portable into their larger economies. And the two good stories are Samoa and Kiribati. Again, very small countries. Samoa has a population of 200,000, very much in the ring of fire in terms of natural vulnerability to natural hazards, but has undertaken enormous measures, both hard and soft, and by hard I mean literally the sorts of things that engineers focus on, pavement thickness, seawalls, soft measures in terms of education and awareness, to actually build resilience. And we have concrete data, which I'm not going to put up a graph or anything to show you, but it is in a report here called Not If, But When, and I have a few copies, and they're obviously available on the website, which talks about Samoa and Kiribati. And it's interesting, it's actually quite heartening to see that the severity and the frequency of natural hazards in Samoa has actually been going up. But the damage and the mortality rates have actually been coming down. So the simple message is that building resilience actually pays. And this is a message we want the Samoans to disseminate to the rest of the Pacific and the rest of the world. The other is Kiribati. Kiribati, at its highest point, is 3 meters above sea level. It is a very, very remote part of the Pacific. It's in the northern Pacific. It's also not a contiguous mass. To get from one end of Kiribati to the other can sometimes take a week. You often have to go through the United States to get from the west to the eastern part of Kiribati. So connectivity is very poor. And the capital, the main island, Tarawa, is only 450 meters wide. So you put all that together, it is extremely and about 50% of the population lives there. So it's extremely exposed to climate change. When you go to Kiribati, you see people who have actually had to move already because the sea level has risen slightly, or because the food that they depended on, which is just food that's grown, nothing processed, is just simply not available because seawater has inundated the water lens. We had actually done some work in Kiribati in the year 2000 and pointed out that unless very serious adaptation efforts were undertaken, the scenario was not good at all for Kiribati. And their president took it on extremely seriously, disseminated this message, brought about behavioral change, completely mainstreamed climate change issues, got the donor community to work with him. So along with the World Bank, AusAid and NZAid have played a very valuable role. And as I said, larger countries are actually looking at Kiribati and looking to see how this very sort of grassroots level consultation has actually been taken up all the way up to the president and able to be mainstreamed. And their president has a very interesting and an inspiring quote here. He is very much seen as the face of someone who's taken on climate change in the Pacific. I'll read this to you. He said, our inability as a global community to agree on a unified stand on climate change and sea level rise is most disappointing. Our very existence is at stake if this thinking prevails. And again, this is not a hypothetical scenario. He really means that their very existence is at stake. We have demonstrated remarkable solidarity in the fight against global terrorism. Can we not demonstrate the same in the fight against climate change and sea level rise? And this is, again, something that they really... It's a very genuine plea from the people from Kiribati. I want to end here, but I'm conscious of the fact that we're a month away from Bali, where I imagine that there will be a lot of talk on blame. Who's to blame for climate change? Who's going to pay for climate change? What sort of pricing mechanism do we bring in? I would just leave you with one message, which is what the bank is really keen to underscore, that the focus really ought to be on how to protect the interests of the poor and vulnerable. And the vulnerable are already at the limits of their vulnerability, so this is really something that threatens to wipe them out. And our message, and actually our plea would be, to keep the development agenda and the climate change agenda very closely intertwined, because that's the only way to serve the interests of the poor and the vulnerable. Thank you.